One summer day on vacation, I walked along a seawall in Tacoma, Washington, with my niece Susie and her daughter Amalia, who was 4 years old. Susie and I are deeply fond of each other, but we are at opposite ends of the earth when it comes to religion. So we were having fun discussing our differences. I would have had more fun, except that I kept thinking Amalia was skipping too close to a 10-foot drop, and that one misstep would send her tumbling headfirst onto sharp rocks and into the cold seawater. I said, maybe we should keep her a little closer to us, a suggestion Susie rejected because, as she put it, her daughter had a guardian angel who would manage things properly. God was in control of Amalia's life, and if she did fall, it would be because God had some lesson to teach, and we would have to accept that. Children often skip on seawalls, of course, and only occasionally does one slip and fall. And since Amalia was safe that day, I'm sure my niece came back to the house confirmed in her confidence that God watches after little girls who walk in risky places. But given the number of apparent accidents that do happen, hanging on to the idea of special divine intervention must not always be easy. About a week later, Amalia's little sister, Galen, had to have surgery for a congenital sinus problem. God not having seen fit to intervene to prevent that. And she had just come home from the hospital when she pulled a cup of scalding water off a stove onto her head and had to be taken back. Knowing her mother, I'm sure she fit that too into her scheme of faith. God had a lesson to teach from the sinus failure, she would say. And it was part of his will also that the hot water burn the baby's head and face. Otherwise, it wouldn't have happened. This confident explanation leaves her mind at rest. But I have some trouble with that theology. I think there are such things as accidents, pure and simple, and that one can get into mental and emotional danger by involving God in everything that happens in a normal human life. The Bible, depending on how one reads it and which parts are stressed, certainly lends support to Susie's view. Hebrew Scripture especially, and especially the part of it we call the Old Testament, describes a people who believed their God was directly responsible for everything. If it rained, it was because his hand turned the faucet. If it rained until there was a catastrophic flood and thousands died, they were obviously wicked and deserved to die, or a just and intervening God would not have let it happen. If a volcano erupted, no one knew how to speak of the earth's molten middle, left over from the Big Bang and the collapse of matter. When the fiery lava poured down the mountain flanks and engulfed a village, the gods were obviously angry. Someone, perhaps everyone, had given offense. When an earthquake shook a city and thousands died, those who survived tried to figure out who had done wrong to bring such divine punishment on their loved ones. No one had ever heard of massive tectonic plates floating on the earth's mantle and occasionally slipping suddenly as they rubbed past each other. They had only one answer for the eternal why of human existence: God's will. However inscrutable the event, however painful the death of children too young and innocent to deserve God's wrath, it was nevertheless His doing, and they accepted it. That is, most of them. Not all, not even in Hebrew Scripture, where the orthodox view was that a careful system of divine justice operates in the natural world as well as the moral. The good are rewarded and protected, the bad are punished. Clear as crystal, sure as sunrise, a world of black and white morality with no troublesome gray in between. Until some great and sensitive religious poet came along who said, "Sorry, folks, but you're all wrong about how life is." And he gave them a case history to prove it, of a man as perfect as a man could be, with an ideal family, a huge estate, excellent health, and the goodwill of everybody in town. All those blessings the religious establishment took as proof of God's favor. But a man who, despite all of this, was suddenly crushed by one tragic blow after another. Property all gone overnight, the 7 strong sons and 3 lovely daughters all killed at once when a tornado hits the house, the man's own health ruined with a loathsome disease, and all the neighbors whispering behind their hands that he must not have been so good after all, because look what has happened to him. If I had my pick of all the characters in Hebrew Scripture, Moses, Joshua, Saul, David, Solomon, the whole dynamic lot of them, the one person I would choose to know, if there could be only one, would be the unknown poet who wrote the book of Job. He had more courage, in my view, than any of the rest. He dared to stand up in the face of long and powerful tradition and say, "Our view of God and of how God works is all wrong. Some people do not deserve what happens to them, not by any standard of justice. And if you open your eyes and look, you will see that good people often suffer, scoundrels often live well, and things happen which are not related to whether we are virtuous or wicked." "I don't know how to explain it," he said to them, "but your faith is too simple and too easy for me, and I challenge God Himself to explain it." What a stubborn, sturdy iconoclast Job was. I'd love to have met him, even for one day. By the time Jesus of Nazareth came along, the views of that brave poet had shaken people up a bit. The philosophy of Jesus is more complex than the orthodoxy of Job's time. The rain, he says, falls on the just and the unjust alike. If you put it in moral terms, nature is neutral. Good things happen to bad people. Bad things happen to good people. That's how it is. one day, talking to his friends, he reminded them how a tower had toppled over and killed 18 people. Everybody talked about it throughout the neighborhood for months. Was it divine punishment? There is no hint from Jesus that it was. He reminded them of the day when soldiers broke in upon some Galilean worshipers while they prayed and slaughtered all of them. Sounds a little like the Hebron Mosque. Great timing. Kill them while they're on their knees. I can imagine Jesus heard his mother speak of that horror to her neighbors and wonder why. I remember reading a book called The Day the World Ended about the awesome eruption of Mont Pelee in Martinique, which buried between 30 and 40,000 men, women, and children in 3 minutes in the city of St. Pierre. The world was horrified, especially since it happened on a holy day, Ascension Day, in 1902, when morning mass was underway just as the earth split open at 8:03. Was the God to whom all those prayers were being sent angry? Those for whom that explanation was too easy pointed out that of the three people said to have survived in St. Pierre, one made it because he was in an underground dungeon awaiting execution by the guillotine on the following morning. Babies died by the score, but this convicted criminal lived to a ripe old age, supporting himself by appearing as an exhibit in Barnum's Circus, billed, with slight exaggeration, as the only surviving citizen of Martinique's chief city. He made it a bit difficult to preach sermons on the justice of God. You may have guessed already why I choose just now to speak about such things. A few days ago at 11:32 on a Sunday morning, while the kids in the Goshen United Methodist Church at Piedmont, Alabama, were rehearsing a song called Jehovah Jireh, a tornado hit. The church caved in. 90 people were injured, 20 people died, including 6 children under 12, all shining and bright in their Easter outfit. Jehovah Jireh, by the way, translates, "The Lord will provide." An irony that did not go unnoticed by some who pointed out that although there were empty cotton and soybean fields all around, the tornado's path brought it right over the little church. There were plenty of grieving hearts that night, asking over and over in the darkness, why? No answers I have heard or read answer that question adequately for me. The problem is that we were taught prayers as children that personalized, please listen carefully, prayers that personalized the encounter between the weather and ourselves as encounters between God and ourselves. If we ask Him out of His goodness to give us a bright sunny day for our picnic, out of what does He act if it rains instead? And all of us spend the day huddling in some dark and dreary shelter. It's a futile question. The weather is not a personal response of any god or gods. Last night, David and Cheryl Olson of this congregation saw their daughter married in this room. Since rain had threatened all day, it would have been quite normal for them. I didn't ask, but I think it would have been quite normal for them to have thought little prayers. You know, just keep it dry, O Lord, till midnight at least. But I'm sure hundreds of farmers who go to church were also thinking their own little prayers. Let it pour, Lord, today, tonight, and tomorrow. Prayers that are in conflict about the forces of nature create a theological problem, don't they? I know that the ancient Jewish writers thought God brought down huge hailstones once on the heads of their enemies and killed them by the score, and that he stopped the sun in mid-sky so Joshua would have a longer day to slaughter his enemies. But that was part of their mythology and none of mine. We're not always grateful enough to the science that delivered us from having to wonder after every storm who made God angry. Earthquakes, volcanoes, tornadoes, floods, plagues. People have died by the millions through human history, and those who lived and loved them have tried desperately to justify the God they thought caused such things. But as we learned about sanitation, the plagues stopped wiping out whole cities. And as we learned to chart the course of hurricanes, we found ways to warn people. Those who move away from fault lines do not die from earthquakes. Those who move away from volcanoes do not die from floods of lava. But some cannot move. Ever so often, the people of Bangladesh are killed by the thousands by floods, typhoons, starvation, disease. I cannot imagine a moral reason. I do not think God likes them less than he likes me. I think they had the bad luck to settle in a dangerous place and the bad luck to be so poor and ignorant that there is little they can do about it. Those of you who seek lessons in history know how deeply shocked the Christian conscience was when an earthquake killed 30,000 people in Lisbon on All Saints Day in 1755. Now, since God still got credit for natural disasters, some Protestants called the quake a punishment from heaven on a city with far too many Catholics. While some Catholics believed God was angry with them for allowing too many Protestants to worship and recruit in their city. The old skeptic Voltaire said, "You're both crazy. Accidents happen." They will happen again, of course, either because we will not or cannot take ourselves out of harm's way, or because some forces of nature are beyond our control. But we have blunted some of the weapons which people once thought God used to punish the wicked. Think only of the terrors of bubonic plague, smallpox, polio, now gone because of the work of scientists who have diminished nature's power to make life miserable. It bothers me a lot, by the way, that pulpits often make fun of scientists for believing in something like evolution, for example, or for doubting the historicity of Noah's Ark, without ever thinking to give those same people immense and grateful credit for having made life better in so many, many ways. That is not fair. But no matter how many diseases we conquer, or how many warnings we devise against the caprice of nature, there will still be accidents, senseless accidents, that rob us of people we love and test our faith in a world of purpose. You will remember this. A woman traveling with her 7-month-old baby, properly strapped in the back seat, stops to help a motorist whose car has gone into a ditch, a modern reenactment of the parable of the Good Samaritan. The woman's own car is not able to pull the other one out. She moves it back out of the way, then goes a few feet away from that spot to help others who have arrived. While they work, she goes back to check on her child, a concerned mother, as well as an idealistic neighbor to a stranger in trouble. All is well, so she steps away again to help. And behind her, the car suddenly bursts into flame and her child dies. I may be deficient as a minister, but I have no glib and easy answers for such things. If I am to believe one writer's definition of God as love, then I can make no sense out of many things that happen, except to say that love would want us to respond to our own good luck with humility and grace, to feel generous and want to share with others, and would want us to respond to tragedy in our lives with courage and dignity, believing that even from the tragic hour, it is possible to claim some small victory. Unlike some of his later followers, Jesus never promised we would be delivered from suffering, only that the transforming presence of His Spirit in ours would help us overcome, and that those ordinary people who help others in times of tragedy are the truest and best of all the heroes of earth. I believe that.